Thanks.
Thank you. Beautiful. I know some of this dark, underworldly, mysterious, death-like terrain of the confrontation with the muse, so thanks for that. No, I don't need that, thanks. Hey, everybody. Yeah, so as promised, you know, we're in the middle of a series called The Great Questions, and as promised, I get around to the question of God. So here we are. So I'm going to talk about God today, the question of God, which I called part one, and then I just put in parentheses million, because what am I going to say about it at this point? yeah, but first a personal admission. So before I was like a mega church pastor a number of years ago before I quit that, and I was a high school religion teacher. And I worked in this office, not only was a teacher, but I worked in this office called the Spiritual Life Office. And so at one point the administration said to us, well, we need a way of sort of assessing the spirituality of our students. I thought you guys were all into science, you know, and measurable things. So anyway, it's actually a very interesting question. And so I started doing some research, and I was reading the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. They'd started putting out these studies that they had done on spirituality and how people identify and what a spiritual life is to various kinds of people, groups of people. And I was reading the questionnaire. I was sort of taking the questionnaire. And this was, I don't know, 10 years or more ago. And it was the very first time I encountered the nuns, the so-called nuns, no particular religious affiliation. And the very first time I ever heard the phrase, spiritual but not religious. And I thought, oh, that's me. It's like, oh, there I am. How exciting to have, you know how it is when you first like meet a group that you feel some connection with? You're like, yes, all right, we're in this. But it's sort of an odd one, like, we're in this together, although there's no particular thing that we're a part of, and it can't be organized. So, you know, I had some resonance with that. I suppose just because of my own personal religious hang-ups, and also I have a kind of a rebellious streak in there, and, you know, I'm also working for a religious organization, so that's a fun box to check if you work for a religious organization. And I guess I want to say, I want to speak sort of personally, that kind of expression worked for me for a while until it didn't. Until I started really, I don't know, wondering more deeply, well, what kind of stance do I have in the world? And what is my relationship with the transcendent or God or the divine or oneness or reality with a capital R? And I guess what I'm discovering is that in a way I'm actually deeply religious, at least in the sense of I try to orient my life around the sacred, around what ultimately matters. That's how I'd like to stand in the world. That's how I'd like to be in the world. I'd like to stand with a certain kind of posture in order to be confronted by reality with a capital R. So that makes me a religious person, I suppose. I guess by my own definition. And of course, I know a bit about the Latin origins of the word religion, which means to rebind. And I'd like to be rebound, in a sense, to what's ultimately true. So in that sense, I'm kind of deeply religious. And also, I happen to think that the question of God is one that's worth wrestling with. Like, what do we mean when we say words like this? And I might as well add, I got an email from Wayne earlier, maybe last week or something, and he was just adding a contribution to the great questions, and it went something like this: well, how shall we live? Or how shall we then live? Or something like that, and if I got that correctly. And that's also what I'm asking by asking about the question of God, because I'm not just interested in A or B, exist or not exist. You know, is that what we're being asked to do? I mean, it's like what Andy was talking about in the meditation. Well, okay, how am I going to live? And I'd like to suggest one's posture toward what's real, with a capital R, or what's ultimately the case, matters. It matters. And I don't think it's as simple as an A or B kind of choice. God is dead. God is not dead. You know, both are statements of faith, you know. And both are religious in one sense. To say God is dead is a religious statement. It's like, well, I'm orienting myself toward what I think is ultimately the case. And what I think is ultimately the case is there is no God. Well, that's a certain kind of even religious posture. And it's also a claim about what's ultimately true. So I guess this is in part why Jung said we have a religious instinct. We can't even help it. I've talked about that before. I don't want to go into tremendous detail about Jungian stuff at the moment, but I think he's probably right. We do have a religious instinct, an impulse that helps beg the question, what is ultimately the case? And we keep being drawn to it in one way, shape, or form. So I want to actually come about this in a very roundabout way, and in a sense, a very mystical way. I want to read a passage from Thomas Merton. And Thomas Merton is a Cistercian. He's a monk. Well, he's born in France, but his father was American, and he eventually made his way to America, and I think he went to Columbia. And while he was at Columbia, he converted to Catholicism, and eventually he decided to join the monastery. He wanted to be a Franciscan, but ended up in the Cistercians, which is a French order, and also they took a vow of silence. And what's amazing, he's like one of the most prolific writers of the 20th century, and he did so as a cloistered monk taking a vow of silence. And I love Thomas Merton, and I've quoted from him in the past, and I like him because I can't tell what age he is while he's writing. Like, is this a 5,000-year-old document? Is this a medieval document, or is this like another line from Bob Dylan? I can't tell. And he's that kind of person. And the reason why I want to turn to Thomas Merton is because he, more so than any other person, at least writing in English, all of those whose books were translated into dozens of languages, helped bring the question of, I guess, what he would call contemplative or mystical Christianity, or just contemplation more generally, back into contemporary spiritual conversation. It had gone dormant, as the great underground river always appears to go. It appears to be dormant for a while, and then it resurfaces. And Thomas Merton was kind of hosting a mystical conversation around the divine and around the spiritual life. And anyway, so I'm drawn to him, and I want to try to just wander in the terrain of the question of God from the stance of a contemplative, not from the stance of a scientist, nothing wrong with the science, not even so much from a standpoint of theology, although Merton is a kind of theologian, but from the standpoint of contemplation. I'll try to divine that for us in a few minutes. So that's what I mean. I want to wander in that terrain. So that's where I'm kind of going. But let me first raise some questions, like, about how relevant our beliefs are about God. So let's just take a very simple statement. I don't believe in God. Okay, so I don't believe in God. Let's try to make things worse for a moment. Who is the I that's doing the speaking here? You know, what do we mean by I? Who's the I? Is it the ego? Is it your persona? Is it some wounded part? Is it your so-called true self? What is the I that can make such a claim? And what difference does your claim make one way or the other? So there's that. And then I don't believe in God. Well, then you have the question of belief. And what is a belief? How do you know you have one? How do you know that your belief corresponds to something that's real? Whatever we might mean by real, how would we know such a thing? And is it possible that you have false beliefs? I've said that before. My friend who's a philosopher at ASU, he likes to ask his students, do you think you have false beliefs? And you're like, no, I don't. Wait a minute. I don't have thoughts. Well, I probably do, but I don't know what they are at present. That's probably the best response for it. So I don't believe in God. Okay, so we have to talk about belief, and then we have the sticky question of what the heck are we talking about when we say God? It's like two people can say, I believe in God, and mean two very different things by the very word God. Or two people can say, I don't believe in God, and they're not operating with the same definition. And I'm not even saying we all have to be on the same page, but we don't really know what such a statement means. And I can flip the same thing around and say, I do believe in God. I believe in God. I just believe it. And you have the problem of the I, and you have the problem of the belief, and you have the problem of the thing to which you're trying to speak. And then you have the question of knowing. By the way, I don't know if this is worth Googling, but not now, please, maybe later. You should Google Jung's interview with the BBC. So he did an interview shortly before he died, and it's in black and white, I think. That's my memory of it, at least. And he's sitting there, like, smoking a pipe, and he's in a little chair, and the BBC is very formal. And they say, do you believe in God? And he kind of, like, squirms just for a second, Jung does, and he says, I don't believe I know. And the interviewer sort of was like, what? I mean, he's British. He wasn't saying what, but it was that kind of thing. And so Jung kind of repeats himself. He's like, I don't need to believe. I know. He doesn't say, I know God. He just says, I know, and leaves it at that and kind of moves on. What do we mean by knowing is kind of where I'm going. What do we mean when we say we know something? And of course, Jung talked about the windows of knowing. You have thinking, feeling, sensing, and intuition, and which window is operative. And we all have all four windows of knowing, of course, but some are more dominant than others. And some people, when they say, I believe in God, that's largely the thinking mind, as if they made two columns. And column A was reasons for, and column B was reasons against, and they did the math, and they thought to themselves, it doesn't make any sense. And other people, they maybe much more are operative in the feeling realm. I just feel. I just feel there's a God. I went outside and I just felt God. And okay, well, how are you going to argue with that? No, you didn't. And also we live right now, especially probably in the last 5 years, you know, it's almost like we live in a cult of feelings. Whatever feelings are present are true, you know. So, you know, I guess I'm asking an epistemological question. I'm just stirring the pot here about what do we think we know besides what we believe. So maybe I want to say before I turn to Merton, I think we're in a new place when it comes to the question of God. It's a perennial question, you could say. You know, as a student of comparative religion, there's not a people group that I know of, people group, geographical region of the world from a historical point of view, that hasn't posited something like gods, goddesses, divine, spirit, something like that. So it's a perennial question. But there's something new about the world now and the present moment we find ourselves in that I think the question of God is relevant, and it's like our old images and sort of worn out ideas, we're asking, are they still helpful? Are they not helpful? And we have a more expanded view of what the world is or what the universe is. I mean, 14.5 billion years old, that doesn't make any sense. You know, I just thought of, like, there's a comedian I like, Pete Holmes, and he has this little bit. I'm not going to cuss as much as, or at all. I'm choosing not to cuss right now, but you'll get the point. He says, that doesn't make any effing sense. You know, we're in infinite space, and infinite space is growing. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. And a 4.5 billion year old Earth? Somebody's like, oh no, 4.6. You know. And maybe you saw those images of space. You know, what is the world? Or I think of Mary Oliver, who made the world? Who made the black bear and the grasshopper and the black frickin' hole? Who made that, you know? And it's disturbing, it's existentially disturbing. Not only does the unit, like sometimes I see those images of space and I also just think of the matter or the dark matter that's between these realms. Like, what is this? So it's disturbing and also kind of enlivening at the same time. And it does beg the question of the divine, of God, of reality, of the mystery, if you want to use those words. So I think the question is still of utmost importance. That's just my personal view. And how we relate to ultimate reality, whatever that may be, is of ultimate importance. At least to me, that's the claim I'm making. Okay, so let's turn to Merton. I'm going to read this passage. Don't read ahead. Okay? I'm just going to take one paragraph at a time. And how what stance might you take when you listen to Merton? Well, I want to suggest you take the same stance as you might take listening to a good song or a new song. You just let it come. You let it wash over you. You let it be in your field of awareness. That's how I suggest you listen to Merton here. And I'll make a few comments kind of in between things. Okay, here it is. Contemplation is the highest expression of man's intellectual and spiritual life. He means humanity here. He's writing a number of years ago. Contemplation is the highest expression of man's intellectual and spiritual life. Time out. Okay, let's ask, what is contemplation? And technically, it's the act of looking attentively at something. To contemplate something is to offer your attention and to be attentive, to hold something in a kind of continuous, attentive posture. It also means, technically, with, that's the con part, and you can hear the word temple in contemplation. So it's like holding a kind of sacred space. That's really what contemplation is. You don't have to be so-called religious to do so, or believe in this or that. You've probably contemplated something in your life. You've held something attentively. Okay, so I'll start again. Contemplation is the highest expression of man's intellectual and spiritual life. Also, I might add, since we're only on sentence number one, it's not just, oh, I just feel. I'm just all about the feeling world. He's combining worlds, intellectual and spiritual. It can involve your rational mind as much as your feeling sense and your intuition and your imagination. Okay, I'll try to get to the second sentence. It is that life itself, fully awake, fully active, fully aware that it is alive. It is spiritual wonder. Contemplation is spiritual wonder. Remember I said a few weeks ago when I talked about Heschel, that he said the beginning of all religion is awe. You know, that's a lot different than Ernest Becker's the beginning of all religion is the denial of death. Maybe the denial of death evokes a certain kind of awe, I don't know. Can you feel that though? Contemplation is the highest expression of man's intellectual and spiritual life. It is that life itself, fully awake, fully active, fully aware that it is alive. It is spiritual wonder. It is spontaneous awe at the sacredness of life, of being. I would like to live like that, to tell you the truth. It is gratitude for life, for awareness, and for being. It is a vivid realization of the fact that life and being in us proceed from an invisible source, which he capitalizes here. Did you create you? Did you dream yourself into existence? It is a vivid realization of the fact that life and being in us proceed from an invisible source. Contemplation is, above all, awareness of the reality of that source. Awareness of that, of the reality of that source. Just feel how that's a little different than believing in source or God or the divine or have a name for it. It's just, he's saying there's, it's possible to stumble into a kind of awareness of the reality of source. So it's a posture of awe, a relationship, a wondering, a gratitude. And I think to take a stand with this sort of posture, which I think is a combination of gratitude and also requires a little not knowing here, is important. And so let me ask some basic questions. Do we need more gratitude for the sacredness of life? Yes. That's my answer. Take the word sacred out. Do we need more gratitude for life? Yes. Would that benefit nature, culture, families, and human beings? Yeah, I think so. Which is another way of saying contemplation might be needed in the world. What happens to the human spirit, to human cultures, when we have no relationship with source? That's a genuine question I have. What happens? Okay, that's paragraph one. Now, in case you think this is all like good times, and we're all just going to sit and it's all going to be union and oneness and light. Contemplation, next paragraph, is no painkiller. It's no painkiller. It is this steady burning to ashes of old worn-out words, cliches, slogans, and rationalizations. That hurts, he's saying. To really hold something with that kind of awareness, to touch the sort of gratitude, to have an awareness of source, might burn your world up, he's saying. What world? Well, the world of your own ideas, your own ego's conception of reality, the things that you hold even most precious, the things that frame the world and say, this is that and this is this, they can burn up like ash. The worst of it is that even apparently holy conceptions are consumed along with all the rest. All your pretty thoughts about God. Remember, who's writing here? A Cistercian monk in a long white robe. All right? He's writing to his own brothers and sisters saying, all of your holy ideas are ash if you bump into this kind of awareness of source. They're burned up. It is a terrible breaking and burning of idols. A purification of the sanctuary. There's the hint at the word temple or contemplation. So that no graven image may occupy the place that God has commanded to be left empty. The center, the existential altar, which simply, quote, is. Who is this person, Thomas Merton? Who writes like this, first of all? He's saying something like, at the center is nothing, which is God, which is the isness of all things. Now, what's amazing about what he's alluding to me, is how rooted this is in the Hebrew Bible, in the Old Testament, in Judaism, where in the center, in the Holy of Holies, there's nothing. Or if you ask someone back in the old days, what's the name of God? We don't know, we can't really say it. Like in Judaism, you have the tetragrammaton, the Yud Heh Vav Heh, Yahweh, and you're not supposed to say it. You're not allowed to say it. You're not even sure how it's pronounced. Now, that's strange. Do you feel what an odd impulse that is? Who's your God? I can't really say. Where does he live? In that building. Well, what's in there? Well, if you go all the way in the middle, nothing. That's a contemplative relationship with the one, with the divine, with source. It's saying we know something and we also don't know. We're trying to name something, and we have to be careful about naming anything at all. I'm going to read this sentence and then go on to the next paragraph. It is a terrible breaking and burning of our idols, a purification of the sanctuary, so that no graven image may occupy the place that God has commanded to be left empty. The center, the existential altar, which simply is. Okay, next paragraph. And then we're done, it's all going to make sense, you can go home. In the end, the contemplative suffers the anguish of realizing he no longer knows what God is. How many of you have felt this? I have. Do you know when I quit my job, I gave a sermon. It's a good way to quit. And in my talk, I had read Thomas Merton, but I was not thinking of this line, and I started reading Merton again recently, and it only struck me like an arrow right through the center of my being. I said in my talk, almost accidentally, I don't know what I mean by God anymore. So I can't stand at the center of this place. I didn't realize on one level that that itself is a kind of contemplative experience. Listen to what Merton is saying. In the end, the contemplative suffers. I'm not claiming to be a contemplative. I'm really not. I'm just saying I know the taste of this. In the end, the contemplative suffers the anguish of realizing he no longer knows what God is. Now listen to this. He may or may not mercifully realize that after all, this is a great gain. It's a gift, in other words, to be given this stripping, this burning. It is a great gain because God is not a what, is not a, quote, thing. Now, just pause for a moment. Isn't that the way most people treat the question of God? Is God a thing? In other words, does God exist? Is God a thing among things? Like we'll just keep going to the very edges of the universe, which is expanding, so we got to go even faster so we catch up with it. And then just out there, there's the thing that we call God. He's saying God is not a thing. Or a what? Next sentence. This is precisely one of the essential characteristics of the contemplative experience. It sees that there is no, quote, what that can be called God. There is, quote, no such thing as God, because God is neither a what nor a thing, but a pure who. Now, here's where I start to be like, I start to feel a little loopy. Like, I think I know what he means. I don't know what he means. The first part, I don't know. There's something about this that I find very powerful. Now, just use your imagination. Here he is. Little Cistercian monk sitting there at his writing desk. He's got a pen of a raven's pen, a quill. I don't really know if he had any of this stuff. And he's writing these words, there is no such thing as God because God is neither a what nor a thing. Do you feel how he's wrestling with the question of God, but from a completely different standpoint than most of us do? It's like he's saying, we're talking about the wrong thing. So we'll end with his words here. God is a thou. He's really nodding to Heschel here. They corresponded a bit. He is a thou before whom our inmost I springs to awareness. The I am, the you that you are, that co-arises in the field of awareness, rises within what he's calling God, as a thou, as a who, not as a thing. There's no such thing as God. You don't go around chatting with God as if it's a thing, like the way I chat with birds and trees and my kids. It doesn't work like that, he's saying. I know this makes sense and doesn't make sense. He is a thou before whom our inmost I springs to awareness. He is the I am before whom With our own personal and inalienable voice, we echo, I am. You know, who is it? I think, therefore, I am. That's Descartes. Thank you. Merton is backing way up. He's saying the experience of I am rests inside an I am that you can be relationally aware of, that can't be proven as a thing or a what. You co-arise within the larger I am. And he's saying this kind of posture in the world, you're invited to join into. Now, even if, like me, you get to these final sentences and you're like, I don't get it. I kind of want to get it. I kind of get it. I don't get it. I don't know what he's talking about. I know what he's talking about. That's the right kind of place. I mean, he's coming from a long line of mystics that say to get close to this kind of experience is to enter a cloud of not knowing, right? Where all your knowledge is taken from you and you're enveloped in a cloud of not knowing. So let's leave that aside and back up to the first paragraph because I want to remind you of some things. Why I think the question of the divine, this is only week two, that's when I'm really going to get after it. I just want to remind you of some of these opening things. Contemplation is the highest expression of our intellectual and spiritual life. It is that life itself, fully awake, fully active, fully aware that it is alive. It is spiritual wonder. It is spontaneous awe at the sacredness of life, of being. It is gratitude for life, for awareness and for being. It is a vivid realization of the fact that life and being in us proceed from an invisible source. So even if the end remains in the cloud, there's something about the beginning. I, at least as a starting place, would like to be in deeper relationship with a kind of sacred approach to life and life itself. Operate with a kind of gratitude and a kind of wonder around the source, the origin, the flow, the thing beneath the thing that is no thing, that is the center of emptiness in which my I am is held in a kind of co-arising awareness. How's that for a sentence? All right, that's it for me. Thanks for listening.